Morning, everybody. So tomorrow, right now, I would like to talk. I could talk tomorrow too, I suppose. Why don't I say something right now? I should be in the now, shouldn't I? Many, many years ago. Tomorrow, many, many years ago, now. Many, many years ago. Actually, about 30 years ago. Thich Nhat Hanh came to visit us here at Zen Center. Before he was famous. Susan and I have talked about this. Before he was famous, he came to visit us here. And he gave probably a couple Dharma talks. I don't know. I remember him giving at least one Dharma talk. And our guiding teacher at the time, Katagiri Roshi, went to pick him up at the airport. And Katagiri came back, and he talked about Thich Nhat Hanh probably to me three or four times after that. And he talked to all of us about that. And he, of course, Thich Nhat Hanh was from Vietnam, had a very different style of practice from Japanese Zen. Our teacher was Japanese, and the Japanese forms very different, actually, than the Vietnamese, but. And the style of practice, very different. But still Zen. And what Katagiri said to me, and what he said to others, is that he went to pick him up at the airport, and in those days, you didn't have to go down to the baggage counter to wait for someone. Anybody remember those days?
Yeah.
You could actually meet them.
Yeah.
And that as he saw him getting off the plane, and as he saw him coming into this big, bustling international airport, felt great silence. And that's basically what he said. And he said to my friend John Snyder O'Neill, before he died, Katagiri said, she said, you know, kind of, who should I practice with after I die? And she said, practice with him. So they had no common language. They had kind of a common culture, the Buddhist, a very different style. But Katagiri sensed a great silence in him, a great silence that pervaded him. And what we do here at Zen Center, what we do in our zafus at home, our cushions at home, is we try to steep ourselves in silence. Katagiri could only have experienced that silence because he himself had steeped himself in silence. Nobody else noticed Thich Nhat Hanh, right? But Katagiri did because he himself had steeped himself in silence. If you steep in yourself in silence, you will begin to feel and sense silence in others. Silence in ordinary activities. Silence around you. But first you have to do this practice of steeping yourself in silence. And recognizing that even in the middle of chaos, there's a potential to do that. Just to do that. Just to be present with an ordinary and yet wonderful stillness. And of course, often that seems when we have that experience, if we've been sitting for an hour or a year or 10 years or 20 years, it seems so fleeting. Oh, and then it's gone. And then we're back in the chatter, back in the noise. But we don't have to despair about this because that silence is not of time. It's not of time. So it's always available if we're of time. Then we could get worried, but you don't need to get worried because it's not of time. That's why it's so still. It embraces time, but it's not of it. Do you understand what I mean? Not of it. It's what T.S. Eliot called the still point of the turning world. It's almost become a cliche, the still point of the turning world. But it's not a cliche, you guys. It's not a cliche. It's something you can really experience for yourselves by steeping yourself in a meditation practice. And of course, what's discouraging for folks, used to be for me too, is that we steep ourselves in silence, sitting here, sitting at home, sitting in retreats, and what happens? Noise. We think we're steeping ourselves in silence, supposedly, but really it feels like we're steeping ourselves in noise. Our own noise, our own chatter, our own worries, our own heartaches, over and over and over. So it gets discouraging. We get our butts down on this cushion to steep ourselves in silence, and the whole world comes in. All of our fears, all of our hopes, all of our regrets. Oh, it's churning through. Churning through. We thought we were steeping ourselves in silence, but instead we've got nothing but noise. Noise. Obsessive thoughts continually bubbling up, tripping around, tripping over each other, tripping under each other. Endless, endless. But in our sitting practice, our sitting practice in steeping ourselves in just being here with the noise, in silence, the noise becomes our teacher. It becomes our teacher. The endless parade of thoughts and figures and dialogues and characters become our teacher. We, just by being with it, it's teaching us about our agony, about our hopes, about our loves, about our obsessions. It's a wonderful teacher. No need to judge anyone in that parade. No need to judge anyone in that parade. Just notice the figures, the characters, as your teachers. They're teaching you something about your life, about your deepest desires and your deepest regrets. And then there's all the chattering about how to, because you don't want to deal with your deepest desires and deepest regrets, you chatter, 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 like a chipmunk. Like a chipmunk. Well, that's teaching too, isn't it? How you cover all this stuff up with your chipmunk chatter, 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 chatter. It's a good teaching, isn't it? It's not something bad. There's nothing bad here. Just being with it. Just being with it. Not indulging the characters in the parade. Appreciating them. When you indulge someone or something, you're not really appreciating them. You indulge them instead of appreciating them. It's much, much better just to appreciate them. Then, all of these characters in the parade become compost for realizing the great stillness that's right here. It's always speaking to us, always speaking around us, always speaking through us. It surrounds the parade, engulfs the parade, enjoys the parade. The great silence that doesn't even know it's silent. How could it know it was silent? It's having too much fun enjoying the parade. I know it doesn't seem like fun, but once you steep yourself in it, you will begin to know, have a sense about what I'm talking about. But you have to steep yourself again and again. You have to put that tea bag again and again in the hot water. And again and again and again in the hot water. Again and again and again. And the flavor of the water will change. It will change. It will come very sweet. Very sweet. So that silence speaks through entanglement, speaks through chaos, speaks through all of our trippiness. And I say this sometimes, but as a Zen teacher, I'm getting kind of tired of having people telling me that their thoughts are out of control, that everybody else has a still mind, but they're just obsessive compulsive by nature. You all tell me that. You all tell me that. What does that mean? What does that mean? It's the human situation, you guys. If my thought dreams could be seen, they'd put my mind in a guillotine. Right? It's the human situation. But we pretend that we are nice and still. We got our act together. We never have our acts together. Forget it. Forget it. But if we shine our awareness on these parade of characters that pass through, including the trombone that's out of tune and the little dogs that are yipping at they think it's a pet parade. It is a pet parade. These are all our pets coming out. If we just shine our kind attention on them, our mind develops a real steadiness that you never realized you had. You never realized you have it, and of course you don't have it. It's not something you have. It's a muscle you develop. A muscle to be steady and still in the midst of whatever. You didn't know you had that muscle, but you do. You do. And the noisy thoughts, we see them and we release them. We see them and we release them. We see them and sometimes they don't want to be released. And we just let them be. Just let them be. This is our path to silence. This is the Buddhist path. To silence through noise. But the silence is always here. So it's not something. It's always here, so it's not something you have to do A, B, C, D, and E, because it's before A. Before A. But we need a lot of help. We need a lot of help. This is not easy. You need to have a friend. You need to have a teacher. You need to have a good environment to sit in. You need to figure out how to not get so discouraged you quit. You need to regulate your life so you don't have too much sort of city stimulation always revving you up. You need to work on all that stuff. You need a lot of help. And so I've always needed a lot of help. I've always needed a lot of help because I'm a two-legged also. You know, I use that term a lot. I think four legs probably need help too. But anyway, we don't understand four leggeds too well. We only know two leggeds. I need a lot of help. So when I was a young man, I needed a lot of help too. As sitting in my home, kind of my home state. Oh, no, kind of my home state. My home, San Francisco, Palo Alto. That's still my home. I've been gone for 45 years, still my home. Can't help it. Just the way it is. You know where I was born, right? So I was sitting in my home, sitting in San Francisco. Sitting in the morning, sitting at night, doing these retreats with my teacher. Not getting too much, getting support from him, but not too much instruction. I wanted more help about how to get from A to B to C to E to E. A is just twirling around. That's not, can't be Zen. can't he help me get from, at least get out of A? Instead, I'm getting more in A all the time. But that's what Zen is about, you guys. Sorry. Anyway, so my friends all had mantras. They were going to the Hindu temple, and then TM was just starting then too, so they were getting TM mantras. Oh, the mantras. I thought, I need a mantra. But Suzuki was not interested in that. He said, your breathing is your mantra. Oh, come on. Come on. You can do better than that. You can do better than that. Breathing? Just the old stupid breathing? On and on and on. It doesn't help me with anything. Sometimes it's deep and sometimes it's shallow. Mostly it's shallow. I know it's supposed to be deep. I know those really advanced Zen students have deep breathing. They breathe from their hara. Forget breathing. Right? I want something more than that. So, since he wouldn't give me more, I decided I would make this my mantra. It's Bob Dylan. I was listening to Dylan in those days, and my favorite album in those days was Bringing It All Back Home, for those of you who are really old or those of you who are really hip. Or something. Or those of you really nostalgic for your parents or grandparents' generation. Bringing It All Back Home. My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. That was my mantra. That was my mantra. I did that to help me stay on the path when I got really mixed up and really discouraged. And it seemed like all I had in my life was noise, noise, noise. I mean, what would be the point of coming in and sitting in the Zendo for 40 minutes and just doing noise all the time? But I needed that support, so I made that my mantra. I only told my girlfriend, and she thought, what? So I didn't talk to her about it anymore. I haven't mentioned to her since. And she was not a Dylan devotee like me. My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. So my teacher, Suzuki, he seemed to speak like silence. He seemed, that's why I stayed with him. So when I heard Katagiri talk about Thich Nhat Hanh, I thought, oh, that's exactly the way I felt about my teacher. He seemed to be in silence, even when he was laughing, even when he was giving a talk. Steeped in it. And so I was romanced by that silence. I was romanced by that. That was my great romantic relationship. I had other romantic relationships, but that's actually still my romantic relationship. Although in those days I thought it was just in him. It was just in him. So I followed him around like a puppy dog, like a little puppy with a mama dog. And we were a whole bunch of puppies and we followed our big mama dog around because he was steeped in silence. We thought he was. We felt it. We felt it. But little by little, you can get a sense that that silence is always available. Available when you're walking on the ice, when you're tripping on the ice, when you're just
Just being. Just being. That silence is always available.
Always available.
So, and it sounds like extraordinary. It's extraordinary. But it's very ordinary. It's not extraordinary. It's just living. Just doing one thing and completely just being here without comparing. So it's not extraordinary. Not extraordinary. We don't have to make a religion about it. Well, we can make a religion about it if we want. I guess it's okay. But not so much of a religion, okay? Not so much. Because then it becomes something... Well, it's not the silence anymore. Because it's our religion, right? My love, she speaks like silence without ideals or violence. Our ideal. Our ideal. To do good Zen practice for me. My ideal. To do good Zen practice. Whatever good is. Whatever good is. To do real Zen practice. Do authentic Zen practice. My ideal. My ideal. And in those days, what I noticed was how everybody, and we did Japanese Zen in those days, Japanese style, so big emphasis was placed on form and the grace which comes out of doing these very beautiful forms that are present in Japanese Zen, which you'll notice if you do one of our long sashins, urban short sashins. Beautiful forms, which evoke silence. They evoke silence, those forms. And my ideal was to do Zen and to try to do those as well as possible. But I just couldn't do it well because I am kind of clumsy by nature. And I noticed these people around me being so graceful. This one guy named Bill Kwong, I was very jealous of because he seemed to just naturally be in his body with fluidity when he served tea, when he... I don't know, did everything, walked in the meditation hall, and I just stumbled. So there was a huge gap between my ideal and the real, right? There often is between the ideal and the real. And if our ideals aren't anchored in deep acceptance of our imperfection, of our needs, of our flaws, there's a huge shadow between the ideal and the real. A huge shadow. T.S. Eliot also said, between the idea and the reality falls the shadow. Big, dark shadow. Big, dark shadow. Between how they are and how they should be. How they are and how they should be. And then when we get caught in that shadow, we don't experience the silence because we're always trying to get to how they should be and kick out how they are. Only when we settle into how they are can we move really toward how they should be. Only when we completely settle into then we can move to how they should be. So 1965 to 1980, counterculture. I just made that up about when it started and ended, but I'm saying that for now. 1965 to 1980, counterculture, which I was in, which a few of us in the room were in. You look at the older people around the room, we were in it. Right? We were in the counterculture. And, of course, our ideal was communal life, communal living. Our ideal was to be there for everyone, to not try to be push people around, not try to get stuff from other people, not be materialistic, not be acquisitive, not be fighting. And what did we do? We fought. We fought in our communes.
I lived in communal life. My wife and I and my children lived in a small commune. I won't say where. I will say where. Northern Minnesota. I know that sounds really strange. We lived in a small commune for 3 years. 3 years. We were all wedded to this ideal, and we weren't paying attention to the real. And so we were fighting about the ideal. We were fighting about what the rules should be, how we would share things. We'll just share. But we were so naive. We'll just share. Because we have ego needs. We have desire. We have hang-ups. And if we get too transfixed by the ideal, we end up creating havoc in our lives and in everyone's lives. So our little communal experience lasted 3 years. A few lasted longer. And you looked at the history of our cultures. Well, look at Karl Marx. I mean, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That sounds wonderful, doesn't it? That sounds like a Buddhist teaching. But all the experiments in Marxism and communism totally failed. Totally failed because they got caught on the ideal. And they didn't pay attention to just this reality as it is. My love, she speaks like silence, with no ideals or violence. With no ideals or violence. So we become so violent in pursuit of our ideal. Look at all the history of wars, terrorism. You know, we call it terrorism if it's the other guy. If it's us, we call it war, right? But anyway, look at it. It's all about ideals. It's not about just being there for each other, just being in stillness with our flaws, with our wounds, just being with each other. It's about our ideals. Jeez! And it's not that the ideals are bad. It's good to have ideals, but they should come from this right here. This stillness right here, rather than because we want to kick out who we are, we go to the ideal. You can't kick out who you are. You are who you are. You are who you are. My love, she speaks like silence, with no ideals or violence, without ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure. So the story that I told in practice period last week, story about my teacher. So my first teacher, Suzuki, both of my teachers were Soto Zen teachers, and there's Soto Zen and Rinzai Zen. And Soto Zen is considered to be like farmer Zen by the... And Rinzai Zen is considered to be Samurai Zen. So we have Farmer Zen and Samurai Zen. Right? So my teachers were both... Well, my first teacher, let's just talk about him, was raised in Soto Zen, Farmer Zen. His father actually was a Zen teacher, Farmer Zen. But he had always been interested in Samurai Zen, in Rinzai Zen. Because in Rinzai Zen, you know, there's a lot more drama. There's a lot of drama in the meditation hall. Mm-hmm. People sit very straight and they get hit with a stick and they run up for their private interview with the teacher and then they run down and they only have 2 minutes to talk to the teacher. You know, it's totally different. But my teachers, sensei, we called him sensei in those days, he wanted to try a Rinzai retreat in Japan when he was a young man. And so those of you who are in practice period can tune this out, because I just told the story. So he goes to this Rinzai retreat, and in the Rinzai retreat, they're all focusing on mu. And I'm not going to talk much about this, because I could go on and on. But mu, which means no thingness, and they're told to in this retreat to breathe and think and be and even say mu from their haras, their lower belly, mu. The idea that they'll have a breakthrough to this great silence, that they'll let go of all their chattering, it was moo. So my teacher is doing the meditation that he's been taught, which is just to sit. Just to sit and watch his breathing. Just to sit and get sleepy. Just to sit and get aggravated. Just to be there with it. Just to watch the parade. So he's watching this parade, and he's hearing, and there's all this commotion around him, all these people mooing, running up and down to see the teacher. And he realizes, he thinks he's missing out on something. He feels like he's just totally a failure. He wants to get back to his farmhouse, Zen. But there he is, and all he wants to get back to it, he's envious of all these people mooing. So he feels like he's totally failed, because these people are not only mooing, they're having these great awakenings, and they're running up to tell the teacher, and running down. I went to one of these retreats years ago. I'm not exaggerating, you guys. I'm not exaggerating. So my teacher is about 5 feet tall. I'm not sure. I change when I'm talking about him. Sometimes I make him 4'11", sometimes 5'1". But, you know, he's a very short man and thin man. And the teacher is a guy named, whose nickname is Tanker, because he's built like a tanker. And he's a Rinzai samurai kind of teacher. And the room, the Doksan room, is a tiny little room. The tanker almost fills up the whole room. And then there's room for one little cushion when you get in the door. And this is all the way they set things up in Rinzai. Different than us. So you barely get in the door, and then you moo at the teacher or something. I don't know. I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert in this. And I don't mean to demean it. I think it's cool. It seems cool to me. Anyway, so my teacher finally has to go up and see this guy. And he's not going to run up. He thinks he's supposed to run up, but he's been taught to walk very carefully up. So he tries actually running up, and then he trips on the stairs. And then he gets up in the room. He opens the door, and he sees Tanker, and he's telling us a story, and he says, "And then I felt like I had felt on the way up that I was totally failed at this, and I opened the door, and I saw that I am Tanker. So that's his opening to the great silence. I am Tanker. And he's, of course, Tanker is huge, and he's tiny. So that's may sound strange to you, but when you steep yourself in stillness with all the noise and allow yourself to fail, you can settle into some commonality with everything, which just surprises you when you feel that you are not separate from anything. Because you read about it, but it was only in your head, it was your ideal. And then when you feel it, when you see someone who's 6'5" and you're only 5'1", and you see that he's you, because he is. And after that, Suzuki Roshi was no longer self-conscious about his height. He was only 5'1", and he didn't ever need to go back to a Rinzai retreat again. He didn't need to be a strutting samurai.
when we're just who we are, when we accept ourselves in our total frailty, then we are everything. We are. Not something intellectual. Not something intellectual.
So, telling another story on myself that I haven't told in a while. But again, this is about allowing ourselves to fail. Allowing ourselves to fail. There's no success like failure. And just being with that. Just being with that. Rather than giving up. It really doesn't matter what you're doing. We could say sitting on the cushion. But whatever you're doing, allow yourself to fail without giving up. So my teacher wouldn't give me a mantra, so I had my own mantra. but he would tell me over and over again when I asked him how I should do things, oh, just do it wholeheartedly. That is sort of the Soto Zen mantra. Just do it wholeheartedly. So I wanted to explain the Heart Sutra to me, which we chant every morning. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no this, no that, no the other, no the other. And he said, no, just chant it wholeheartedly. So I was chanting it wholeheartedly. I was really chanting it wholeheartedly. And then one time I went to Zen Center and I saw a little sign at the door just when I was coming in that was obviously in his handwriting, and it said, chant with your ears. Chant with your ears. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. There weren't very many of us there. So I was sure it was about me. I mean, we always think this is about us, don't we? This is about me. This is about me. I've been chanting wholeheartedly, but I haven't been paying attention to anybody else. Total failure. Total failure. So even wholehearted practice, be careful of that, you guys. Don't turn that into a religion. Pretty soon you'll have blinders on. And you won't be noticing the big world. This big world here, which is steeped in silence. You'll just be religious. Don't get religious. Oh, it's human nature. Human beings want to get religious. Get religious. But watch the parade of religious icons that pass through. The religious demands and commands that pass through. Watch them. with your magnanimous attention. Okay? Wholehearted practice. Or something or other. You know? Just be with it. Then you don't need to be violent. Then you don't have to be violent. My love, she speaks like silence with no ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure. Stumbling along without any grace in my practice, without any composure. Trying to be the ideal student and failing and failing and failing. And when I was in the Zen monastery in Tassajara, they made me the garbage man because I had no manual skills. I'm a klutz, so I had to be the garbage man. From Stanford to being the garbage man. Graduating into being the garbage man. Norm Randolph and I were the two garbage men because we were the two klutzes. Big guy and little guy. True. And then my wife was there with me at the monastery, and she was not even interested in Zen, but she did everything with grace. Oh, that pissed me off. That still pisses me off. I'm glad she doesn't come around here very often. She taught the Orioki before I could even figure out how to fold my first cloth. To everyone and everything. So I felt like I was just like a, a floor that everybody was walking on, a scuff floor, a dirty floor. Suzuki said, keep the floor clean. But, you know, we were a bunch of hippies. We didn't even wear shoes. So keep the floor clean. So the floors at Tathagata were gross by his standards, not by our standards. I felt like I was just like the floor. Everybody was walking on me. I couldn't do the Oreo key right. Those are the nested eating bowls. I was the garbage man. I liked being the garbage man. That was simple. I enjoyed that. But I didn't like not being able to do the eating bowls when everybody else could do them. I didn't like being the last one. I didn't like spilling soup when I was serving in my teacher's lap. Jeez, why did I even choose Zen? I could have been a lawyer. And here I am spilling soup in my teacher's lap. Jeez, there's no success like failure. You want to give up when you fail. But if you stay with your practice, if you stay with it in attentiveness, in openness, then you experience something wonderful. Something wonderful that's not a thing. That's not a thing. So I was felt like I was a floor and everybody was walking on me. And practice period, which was... And it was 2 months, and I thought, God, this is too much. 2 months is way too much that I have to put up with this humiliation. This is ego. This is about ego, isn't it? It's about big-time ego, especially for a hotshot like me. I mean, academically kind of a hotshot, and, you know, et cetera. So then I read at the Zen monastery, I picked up this book on Huayan Buddhism. and I picked up an explanation of Huayan, which is has Zen stuff in it. I'm not going to go into this. By Francis Cook. And Francis Cook, I opened the book, and Francis Cook said, when the floor is just the floor, it is the whole building. Oh! And then he explained that from the Huayan point of view, the floor is the whole building if it's just the floor. Because without the floor, there's no building. The whole building tumbles. The ceiling is just the ceiling. It's the whole building, right? So I felt, so much better. So much better. Is that enlightenment? I don't know. I don't know what's enlightenment. Who cares about enlightenment? Let's just be with what is, and we can discover some stillness there. Even if we're failing, even if it's awful, there it is. There's some wonderful stillness when we don't give up. When instead of giving up, we open up. We open up. She knows there's no success like failure, and that failure is no success at all. Failure is no success at all. Failure, sometimes I say, is like the sand, piece of sand in the oyster. The oyster has to get that piece of sand in it. And we want to get that sand out. But that's where the pearl is. The pearl. If we the piece of sand stays in the oyster, just stays there. Without doing anything. Wonderful pearl is produced. Wonderful pearl. Dogen calls this one bright pearl. He says dogs and cats are one bright pearl. People and animals are one bright pearl. The sun and the moon, the earth are one bright pearl. You can know this for yourself. Just don't kick the piece of sand out of the oyster. Take care of the piece of sand. Take care of it. Take care of it. The wound that lets all beings in. And failure is no success at all. So failure is not what we're aiming for. I want to totally fail. That's what Tim says. I should totally fail. Well, then that becomes our new religion, right? Failure is no success. So my friend Howard Iriyama said to me, you know, Tim, your zazen is so competitive. And I thought, my zazen is competitive.
boy, I've totally failed now. I thought I was doing just what my teacher told me, and I'm competing? How can I be? How can I be? I felt awful about it. So, these things happen in our lives, but this failure, this hitting bottom can be a springboard to opening, can be a springboard to trying without getting caught by some ideal. Discovering then that our deepest identity is just to be here with this and to discover some wonderful silence in this. And then we have some ideals that come out of that. But they're not ideals that we use to sort of cover up or conceal or get away from. Just this, whatever it is. So that's what I want to say this morning. And I would be glad to entertain a question or two. Or something else. Some other sound. A moo. If anybody wants to do a moo. I still like to learn how to do a moo. Moo.
I find it ironic that it's not the farmer that needs a moo.
That's a rather good point. You hear what he said? Kind of ironic, it's not the farmer that said moo. Wow. Any other words of wisdom from the group? Anything else, anyone, this morning? The woman in back of Guy, and then Guy, or the man in back of Guy, I can't see. Oh, the woman, hi, I remember you. Okay, well, I was not happy at Stanford. Stanford sounds like a big deal, but everybody in my family had gone to Stanford. I went across the street to Stanford, and I was not happy there. I was not studying. I was drinking. I have to make this story short. I took a course in abnormal psychology in which I read Aldous Huxley and other people talking about the great stillness, the great silence that the mystics all talk about, the Christian mystics, the Buddhist mystics, the Hindu mystics. And so I forgot then about abnormal psychology. I only cared about that. And I quit going to classes, and I just immersed myself in these books from the Christian and Buddhist mystics, because they were all saying the same thing. They were all talking about this silence that we overlook and we get. And I was amazed. And then to make a long story short, I talked to my Unitarian minister about them, and he said, well, there's something called Zen where you can actually get a taste of this, but I don't know anything about it myself. And then I went up to San Francisco and looked in the phone book under Z and found the Zen bar and the Zen center. And I had a hard time deciding which. I really preferred the Zen bar. But for some reason, the Zen center was closer. So I went to the Zen center, and that's the story. Anybody else? Thank you. Oh, there's somebody else.
Yeah, so once you found the silence, you can't live in silence your entire life. You're at the point. So, like, once you found how to find that silence, how did that change the way you live the rest of your life?
Once I found that silence, how did it change the rest of my life? I don't know. I used to think the silence was in special people, but then I realized that everything is a special person. this is a special person. This right here. This is really a special person. You may not think it's special, but I do. This is a special person. So that changed my life. Maybe so. I don't know. That's all I can say. Okay, enough of this.